Goodman Cancer Research Public Forum. The series, as you know, this is the second topic in the series of today's research for tomorrow's cure, La recherche actuelle vers un avenir sans cancer. So as you probably saw from the first, those of you that were here from the first lecture, we're trying to innovate this year. We're trying to do things a little differently in response to the survey that we distributed last year and what you are interested in hearing about or getting more information on. And we came up with this topic, which is, I've been diagnosed, now what? Navigating the cancer care system. En français, j'ai reçu mon diagnostic, que dois-je faire maintenant? When you're bilingual, I can tell you that the resounding pressure of the English language comes out a lot more than the French, which is nice and subdued. When you are a patient, when you are diagnosed with cancer, the world around you stops for a few seconds. I know, been there, seen it, lived it, still here. So we will hear about that tonight. We'll hear about what all the system is doing to help patients and their families navigate this complex disease and the treatments that everyone will be receiving. For those of you that haven't had the pleasure of meeting me yet, I'm Nicole Beauchemin. I'm a professor in the departments of biochemistry, medicine, oncology, Goodman Cancer Research Centers, which means I have four bosses. Can you imagine? And I've been hosting these series with my colleagues and my friends for the last three, 4 years. And I think we've gone through a number of topics, and I hope that you are enjoying them. So before we go on to the scientific aspects and the clinical aspects, I just want to make sure that I give you this information, because at the end, we're all a bit scrambling to move on. So we still have two regular public forums in this series. These will go in the spring. We're taking a break during the winter. You know how much fun it is to come to McGill now. And tonight there's a fire on Park, which has cut off part of the neighborhood down here, and now you can see what fun we have every day. In addition to this, the white stuff is back. And the city has not done a great job around here in clearing it or salting it or putting little stones, which means be very careful when you leave the forum tonight and make sure you don't slip on these sidewalks, because they can be very slippery at this time of night. So, what are the two forums upcoming in the spring? There's one, they're all on Wednesdays, except the special one I'm going to talk to you about. The Wednesday, April 19th one, this again is going to be something a little different from what you're hearing normally, and it's called Both Sides of the Fence. And this is going to be six speakers, three patients, but the three patients are researchers and staff members of the Cancer Center. And we'll talk to you about three different cancers and how it is to be diagnosed with cancer when you actually work on cancer. It's a little special. The last forum on May 17th, white stuff will be gone, probably, should be on melanoma and skin cancer. And we've got a packed evening with a lot of the people you enjoy hearing about. But this year, we have a special public forum, which will be held, it's a Tuesday. It's on the Tuesday, May 2nd. It hasn't been publicized yet. You will be getting some information later on as everything settles in place. And this is a forum on pancreatic cancer. Everyone knows how much we hear about pancreatic cancer, and we can tell you that there are great advancements in the knowledge of the disease and the treatments of the disease. So we have teamed up. Actually, we're so popular that the Canadian Pancreatic Network phoned us up to ask whether we could help them set up public information sessions and use one of these evenings on pancreatic cancer to show them how we do this and how we do it well. So this will be hosted on May 2nd, and you'll hear from some of the greatest people working in this network, clinicians, patients, but from all across Canada. So you don't want to miss this. It's going to be very important. We're desperately trying to find a big enough room at McGill that is not in a construction zone. We haven't found it yet. Okay, so tonight we will have one clinician, one nurse Pivot, one person who's in charge of a whole bunch of clinical trials and of cancer care management, and one patient. And first, to introduce our clinician, Dr. Cristiano Ferrario. I'm going to come up with all my good Italian. He received his MD degree in 2001. Then he went on to do a specialty certificate in medical oncology from Milan University in Italy at the Università degli Studi di Milano. It's not all. After training in Milan at the Istituto Nazionale Tumori, okay, Dr. Ferrario moved to Montreal, and he worked in basic research at the Lady Davis Institute for 2 years. He was then awarded a number of very prestigious awards, the Terry Fox Foundation Post-MD Research Fellowship, where he then used this to start a clinical fellowship program that lasted for 4 years at the Oncology Department of McGill University. He was training on not just one, three, breast cancer, hepatobiliary, and prostate cancer. In 2011, he decided he had enough of the white stuff and went back to Italy for 2 years and worked there in Meldola. He focused on breast cancer and treatment of testicular cancer with high-dose chemotherapy. Then, of course, we called him back, and in 2012, he accepted a position as assistant professor in oncology. He's now at the Siegel Cancer Center of the Jewish General Hospital. But then he won more awards. In 2012, he was the recipient of the Kate McGarrigle Fellowship Award. In 2014, the Faculty of Medicine awarded him the award for Introduction to Clinical Medicine Oncology Award for Excellence in Teaching. So, welcome, Cristiano. We're quite happy to have you with us. Winter, do you need it?
It's making sense, but it was. Thank you. Good evening. Thank you for having me here. The topic I was asked to tackle is quite generic, but I hope
it will help some of us. And obviously there will be a question field at the end, so I'm willing also to stay over time if necessary. I will talk to you as if you were my cancer patients, so, you know, don't take it badly. But, you know, I think we can, even if we have not been touched personally by cancer, probably most of us here have, you know, a more or less direct experience through some of the people we care about. And so I'm sure you can relate to what they're going to say. So how is cancer diagnosed? This is probably obvious to most of us, but we need a piece of your tumor to know what we're dealing with. You know, we can have the most sophisticated imaging, but this will never be able to replace, at least until now, the value of getting an actual piece of the tumor, of the lesion we need to study, because we need to put this under a microscope and see exactly what we're dealing with. In the presence of multiple lesions, we will try to access the one that is easier to target with a needle. This is an example of a woman with a suspicious nodule in the breast, and you can use ultrasound or imaging to guide the needle in the right spot and take out just a small piece. Sometimes patients are diagnosed with multiple lesions. We have also cases where we find lesions that are probably metastatic, meaning they did not start from the organ where we see them. This is an example of a liver with a very suspicious mass. And we might also not know exactly where this cancer has originated, and that's why we need to do, for example, a liver biopsy in this case, to take out a small piece of that and see if the tumor has originated from the liver or more likely from somewhere else in the body, like the colon, the breast, or the lung, or whatever else. Even in the cases where we knew, in a woman, for example, with a lump in her breast, and nothing else around, we know that if this looks like cancer, we can probably say with certainty this is cancer, and this comes obviously from the breast. We will still need a piece of the tumor, because not all cancer on one tumor type on one site are born alike. We don't talk about breast cancer anymore. Or when we talk, at least when we talk about breast cancer, we imply a whole variety of different subtypes with very different chances of cure, very different types of treatment that can be received for that specific type. So we do need to do some analysis of the proteins that are expressed in the cancer cells, or the genes that are abnormal in the cancer cells that have caused this cancer to be aggressive and growing. And just with a bunch of relatively simple, or very routine analysis that can be done on the cancer biopsy, we can reclassify breast cancer patients into having more or less common forms of cancers, cancer that can be hormonal dependent or not, depending on the presence or absence of the expression of receptors for the hormones. There's a very particular subgroup of patients which is defined by the presence of this protein called HER2. So the patients that have an overexpression of this protein will have a very particular, and very different type of cancer with very particular, very specialized treatments for that cancer as well. And then you have the patients that will have no receptors for the ER, the PR, or the HER2, what we call triple-negative breast cancer, which is a more rare type of tumor, generally more aggressive, and so we tend to use more of the chemotherapy. These markers have been around for a few years, but they have allowed us to develop treatments in each subtype, in a progressively more complex and precise, tailored way. And we have also a new genetics course. We'll talk about this also a bit later on, which are offering us now even more in-depth, analysis of the genetic profile of each tumor. So this, again, we need a piece of the tumor to understand which type of cancer we are dealing with. So the question number one is the type of the cancer. Question number two is, that type of cancer, where is it? What's the quantity of the cancer we are dealing with, and where is this cancer spread at this point? This is what we call the staging. So independent on whether the cancer is triple negative or ER positive, we need to understand where it is spread. This is an example, for example, taken for bladder cancer, which is just one of the tumor types I take care of the most. And for most solid tumors, we apply a classification which is called a TNM staging. It means that we look at three different categories to understand the extension of each cancer. The T category classifies the tumor depending on how extensive, how big it is locally. in the organ, in the teen, the tumor of origin, which can be classified if it's a mass in the breast, for example, depending on the size, you know, the actual centimeters of the lesion. In organs like the bladder or the colon, where the tumor tends to grow and infiltrate through the wall of the organ, the depth of the invasion will help you classify tumor from C1, C2, C3, C4. So depending on how deep the tumor infiltrates and invades through the wall of that organ. The N category is also very important for patients with curable disease. Is probably the most important category in terms of prognosis. This tells us about the status of the lymph nodes. You know, every organ has lymphatic fluid which is drained through the lymphatic system, and these go through like stations on the railway, which are the lymph nodes. And usually, the lymph nodes are the first station where the cancer cells are drained in a more or less passive way. And sometimes the lymph nodes that drain that organ, you know, the lymph node around the bladder or the lymph node in the armpit, in the case of the breast, will be the first place where the cancer cells can migrate and proliferate. So if we do find or we do not find cancer cells growing in the lymph node draining that organ, the patient will have a node positive or negative disease. We can also count how many lymph nodes, and this will determine the risk of the cancer recurring, relapsing in the future. And then probably the most important category is the M category, because what is really dangerous of cancer is that the cancer cells can actually infiltrate from the primary tumor into the bloodstream, into the vessels, and through the blood, they can reach out potentially to any other organ in the body. And if they find what we call a soil, which is fertile for them to grow, they might hide there and start to create like colonies around the body, what we call metastasis. The presence or absence of metastasis far away from the organ of origin is what determines if a cancer is curable or not. So once again, maybe a bit repetitive, but just to say, you know, the patient can have metastasis to the local regional lymph node, and this is still a potentially curable disease in most cases, or can have metastasis far away, you know, in the case of the bladder, you know, even lymph nodes far away from the ones just around, or even, you know, metastasis to the lungs, to the liver, to the bone, will determine, you know, a more spread type of tumor with less chances for a cure. How do we examine, you know, the extent of the disease? Through imaging, so CT scan, PET scan, you know, bone scan, MRI in some cases. This will help us scan the whole body, or at least the organs that are the usual suspects, you know, for a possible metastatic spread, and assess if the cancer has already spread to these organs or not. In cases where we have, you know, where we have a certain doubt, you know, so maybe we can have a small lesion in the lung and the radiologist is not 100% sure whether this is a metastatic lesion or not. If it makes a big difference in how we classify, you know, the staging of the patient, especially if it were to make a difference in how we would treat this cancer, then it would be important to obtain a biopsy also of that lesion to confirm if this nodule in the lung is actually metastatic or not. So as we said, you know, lymph node metastases are not, you know, are not the same as, you know, distant metastases. When we talk about, you know, advanced disease, we usually intend patients with a metastatic spread outside the, you know, the organ of origin and the lymph nodes. And in most cases, these are the patients where the cancer will behave in a chronic way. So the cancer we usually don't foresee curing, at least in most cases. And here's the term that sometimes is used in a very ambiguous way. You know, this patient will receive what is called palliative chemotherapy. I don't like this term. I find it very confusing. You know, palliative, you know, evokes a whole series of images in our mind. I have patients on palliative chemotherapy and metastatic disease for 5-7 years. So, you know, it doesn't mean that these patients will die tomorrow or that there is nothing to do, because from the start we know that this cancer is most likely not curable. Again, and this is important, because I find sometimes there is a certain negative attitude that is, you know, understandably evoked by the diagnosis of an advanced cancer. But, you know, the fact that realistically we cannot expect to cure a cancer by the staging that we have at the beginning doesn't mean that we have nothing to offer to this patient, or doesn't mean that it's not worth it for this patient, you know, to fight and to receive treatment, that even if it's chemotherapy, which doesn't sound particularly sexy to most of us, it does improve the life expectancy and the quality of life in most tumor types, at least at the beginning. So there is a value, you know, in accepting treatments even if realistically, you know, we cannot expect a cure because the cancer has spread too much. This is just a simple example of patients with advanced prostate cancer and how the treatment has evolved just in the space of 10 years. In 2004, we had very little to offer to these patients once the cancer had become resistant to the anti-hormonal manipulation. And then the first drug that was proven to be effective in patients with these advanced, you know, resistant type of prostate cancer was this chemotherapy, which reported, you know, a life expectancy, you know, after this chemotherapy of about 18, 19 months. And you fast forward 10 years with a whole bunch of new treatments that have become available thanks to research, and you see that the same patient population with a very aggressive, undifferentiated, resistant cancer now has a life expectancy that is almost double from what we had 10 years ago. Am I satisfied by this? Not yet. You know, obviously, we want more and more, but it's a sign we are moving in the right direction. We do see, you know, in the space of a few years, a significant improvement of the life expectancy of patients that we know from the beginning will eventually die of that disease. But they can be offered a longer and better quantity and quality of life. Because once again, what is striking to me of this list of agents that became available for prostate cancer, that in most cases we are talking about treatments that are very well tolerated. And in fact, what the research has proposed and given to us in the past few years is a whole growing number of agents other than chemotherapies, which is still very, very important for most patients. But what is interesting is to see more and more of what we call targeted therapy, treatments that are specifically designed to tailor a genetic abnormality of that particular tumor type or that particular tumor subtype. You know, as we said before, even within the group of breast cancers, we have different type of cancers. And so you can see anti-hormonal agents that are used in prostate or hormonal-dependent breast cancer, or you can see what we call tyrosine kinase inhibitors, a whole bunch of small molecules that you take usually by mouth, and that they inhibit certain enzymes which are very important for the cancer cell metabolism, and these shut down the activity of the cancer cells. We have a whole bunch of antibodies that have become available for different tumor types. Some of these antibodies really work very well with the chemotherapy. So again, you don't need necessarily to substitute or to move away 100% from the chemo, but you can also use lighter, you know, easier chemotherapies whose efficacy will be amplified by the combination with antibodies that will target specifically certain proteins in the cancer, on the cancer cell surface, and will make the chemo much more effective without increasing the toxicity. So, you know, another major improvement. And then you see, for example, you know, like this drug, crizotinib, which is extremely effective in patients with a lung cancer and one of these two alterations. That's getting a bit technical now, but what is interesting for you to notice is that these ALK-positive tumors, lung cancer, represent like 5% of the patients with lung cancer. So you understand how detailed our understanding of the different subtypes in every tumor site is becoming. When there is no sign that the cancer has spread beyond incurable, in the absence of metastasis, you know, you do your CT, you do your PET, there's no distant metastasis, that's definitely the most important good news, it means that the cancer, by definition, has a chance of cure. And the chance of cure will be associated, in most cases, with a good local treatment, typically surgery. There are some tumor types which, interestingly, can be treated also by radiation therapy, sometimes with the same efficacy as the surgery. And this is the case for bladder cancer, which can, you know, you can have a protocol of chemo and radiation which can actually spare your bladder if you're lucky, so you don't have to have a whole resection of your bladder out to treat your local cancer. But in most tumor types, surgery is still the most important way to approach locally the tumor, and obviously, you know, the specialty that you need to look for the doctor whose specialty is to deal with that tumor type. So whether it's a urologist, a breast surgeon, a thoracic surgeon, so far, so on. So the most common question, you know, a patient has a small nodule in her breast, the breast undergoes a surgery, the nodule is out, there's no metastasis, everything looks clean, and they come to see me, and I'm crazy enough to propose them to get some chemotherapy. Why am I so evil to do so? I don't hate anyone, but it's a very reasonable question. The patients tell me, you know, why should I go to a heavy treatment, you know, if all my scans are good? You know, I thought we were done with the surgery. Thank God now surgeons are much more aware of the importance of systemic treatment even after the surgery, so they usually prepare the patients for when they come to see us. This is important, the concept of what you call micro metastasis. You know, as we said, the scan would rule out the presence of big, obvious metastases, you know, nodules that you can measure. But if you have a little bunch of a few cells in your lungs, in your bones, in your liver, there's no scan, unfortunately, or no test that will be able to pick up on this one. That's what we call the micrometastatic stage. And we know that this exists because if you take 10 patients, you know, whose scans are cleared, 5 years later, maybe, you know, depending on the original stage of the tumor, 3, 5, 7 of them will have developed metastases. So it means that even if the scans were clean, there were cells hiding. We couldn't see them. And these cells have grown now to the point that we cannot cure them anymore. So this stage of the micrometastatic setting is a particular one because it offers us the possibility of eradicating this small number of cells with the addition of systemic treatment in a few cases. And this systemic treatment is not only chemotherapy. The treatments that are given after the curative intent local treatment are called adjuvant treatment. And this can be adjuvant radiation, you know, to eradicate, you know, the cells that are left in the local regional area where the tumor was. It can be hormonal therapy in the case of prostate or breast cancer. Immunotherapy with antibodies has become also a standard of care for patients with localized disease in the case of HER2-positive disease. By giving HER2-targeting antibodies after the surgery, we have improved the cure rate of these patients in a very, very significant way. So not only in the metastatic setting, no, but even in the cure rate, an amazing result. And then, once again, the chemotherapy, which many people don't like the name, but it does save lives. That's very, very objective. The benefit that each patient will have from a chemotherapy after the surgery is valuable, obviously. So it's not one size fits all. It's not the same for everyone. It depends on two features. You know, some tumors are biologically very sensitive to the chemotherapy. So some tumor type, whatever your initial risk is, will be, you know, the risk can be cut by half or by 30%, you know, with the chemotherapy. Other tumor types have a very different biology and they can be much less sensitive to chemotherapy. And so even if the initial risk is very high, maybe they will not gain much benefit from a chemotherapy. So the biology of the tumor we're dealing with is very important in determining what's the benefit of adding a chemotherapy after the surgery. And even the baseline risk of each patient, you know, which is proportional to the staging, as we said before. So patients in general, very general terms, patients with not positive disease have a higher risk of recurrence, and so potentially they have to gain more from an adjuvant chemotherapy than patients with not negative disease or patients whose tumor was smaller or less invasive locally. So this is the type of assessment we try to do on each one of our patients when we look at the pathology report from the surgery and we decide how much this woman, this man, has to gain from, you know, 6 months of chemotherapy. So we just don't apply, you know, chemo for everyone in indiscriminate way. Neo-adjuvant treatments have the same logic of the adjuvant treatment. So the main goal of this treatment is still to eradicate, to try to eradicate the micrometastases. The difference here is that the treatments are given before the surgery. In some cases, it is actually preferable in some tumor types. In some tumor types, especially when the tumor is very extensive locally, if you have a large breast tumor or if the breast is very inflamed because of the tumor, you want to reduce the tumor size by giving the chemotherapy before the surgery, for example. So the main goal, again, will still be of eradicating the micrometastases, but it can have also the administration of the chemotherapy before the surgery can also help to decrease the tumor burden locally and allow the surgeon to make a less aggressive surgery or less complicated surgery. For example, when we did the surgery, the first studies in breast cancer, we found out that many patients have a significant decrease in the size of their nodules. And so if at the beginning they were found to have a mass that would call for a total mastectomy. If you give them chemotherapy before the surgery, they still get the same advantage, you know, of eradicating the micrometastasis, but at the same time, you can shrink down the nodule and allow the surgeon to do a partial breast-conserving surgery, you know, with better cosmetic results. In some cases, like the case of bladder cancer also, the chemotherapy, for reasons we actually don't even know exactly why, does work better when you give it before the surgery rather than after. So in general terms, it's good for you to look for a surgeon who's the expert of the tumor type that you want to take out of your body. But a very reasonable question to ask your surgeon would be, you know, is there any need for me to meet the oncologist or for you to talk to your medical oncologist to see if any treatment is indicated before we go ahead for the surgery? And as we said, you know, we are trying to move away from the chemotherapy when it's not so necessary. This is a very striking example to give you an idea also how precise, you know, our recommendations are becoming. This is one of the original studies. These are survival curves. I don't know if you can see them. They're very, very small. But these were patients with hormonal-dependent, node-negative breast cancer. So cancer patients that usually will do very well. And you see the red curve here is the patient that will be free of cancer after, you know, 2, 4, 12 years from the diagnosis. And you do see a few patients do relapse, but most of them will do well. When you give chemotherapy to this group of patients with a good prognosis, the recurrence rate is the one indicated by the blue line. So there is a very small, real, but very, very tiny benefit, you know, in getting the chemotherapy after the surgery. So sometimes you have, you know, benefits that are more striking like this, or patients with a prognosis that is much more worrisome, you know, depending on the tumor type. This is an example, of course, from, you know, esophageal cancer that is locally advanced. Again, in the case of breast cancer, non-negative, the prognosis from the start is much better. So is it really worth it to treat all these patients with chemotherapy that will never recur just to get to these maybe 2, 3, 4% of patients that will be cured by the chemotherapy? And that's where a test like the Oncotype DX has been developed. This is a test that is actually available in Quebec and is done on the specimen of the tumor that is resected. So a sample of the tumor is sent out to the States, and they do analysis for 21 genes on the tumor, and they come back to us with a score, what they call a recurrence score. It's a risk of recurrence that depends, that is analyzed in a deeper way than just looking at, you know, the tumor size and the lymph nodes. They have to look at the genes of that tumor. And they get back to you with a result like this one, telling you if the patient has a low risk, intermediate risk, or high risk of the cancer coming back. And as you see here, these are the risks of the cancer coming back if you were to take only tamoxifen, only hormonal therapy. And this is the benefit, you know, how better the risk curve goes down, so to say, if you add the chemotherapy, right? And as you see very well, the higher your score, the more the risk of your cancer coming back, and the greater the benefit that you gain from the chemotherapy. So much so that if you split all these patients into, you know, low score, medium score, or high score, you can see that it's really in the high score that you have that most of the patients that will recur without chemotherapy, and most of the benefits to gain, you know, from the chemotherapy. So at least for this group of patients, it's become a standard now to use tests like this one to try and spare from most of the patients the unnecessary toxicity of a chemotherapy if they're already meant to do well without it. So as you understand, treating cancer is becoming more and more of a what we call a multidisciplinary problem. You know, there is a whole team of people that will be working for you and around you, and I would say with you. You know, most patients will meet in their lifetime a medical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, a surgeon, and it's very important, you know, for these people to work together, you know, with each other, and also to work together with you. Plus, you have nurses, some of them also dedicated specifically to your tumor type, and a whole very important number of people that will support you in all the other aspects that are touched by a cancer diagnosis, and you can see them listed here. But again, the team needs someone to coordinate the team, it needs a captain, and in most patients, in most cases, I would say the patient is the one that has to have an active role in helping us. You know, obviously, we need to do our part and, you know, talk to each other, work together, discuss your case, make plans together. But the role of the patient is not just to sit there and watch a movie and wait for the others to decide about your life. We do appreciate an active role of the patient also, for example, in helping us with communication, with making plans, with confirming things from one side to the other one. So we want you to be active. On the other side, you know, it's not an exam you have to pass. You know, a very common problem that patients have is, okay, I'm seeing the doctor tomorrow, I need to go and ask the most intelligent questions. And they come and ask you, doctor, I want to know what's my grading. And I say, why you care? I don't know, I was told this is a very intelligent question, okay? So you don't come with the problem of impressing the doctor as if you have studied for the exam, right? You need to ask the questions that are important to you, which can be different from the things that I want to tell you, and it can be different from what your mom, your wife, your cousin, you know, or your best friend, or the people that look like they know it all, you know, suggest you to ask, okay? Some people want to know a bunch of details. Other people are much more comfortable knowing the essential and letting us, you know, deal with the details. You need to be comfortable with what you ask. Ask your own questions and not anyone else's questions. So on one side, there are no stupid questions, and on the other side, there are no intelligent questions that you need to ask to show off, right? And tell us what are your priorities. Tell us what's important to you. Sometimes we do have options. You know, maybe I would offer you a standard plan of chemotherapy, but if losing your hair for you is something absolutely unacceptable, you can ask me other alternatives of chemotherapy where I don't lose my hair, and I would tell you yes or no. Yes, it might be slightly less effective, for example. And you say, okay, let's go for it. You know, so it's not one plan for everyone. We want your feedback. We want to know what are your priorities. We want to know what are your worries. And we can try to tailor as much as possible the options to what is important to you. I actually did ask a couple of patients to give me some practical suggestions. And here's what we got from them. So you take it as they come. So one patient says, everyone has a different need for information, as you said before, and how they deal with their diagnosis. Share your preference with the doctors and tell them so that they can adapt to you, to what you need to know and what you want to know. Take notes. This is actually very good advice. Take notes because there's so much that is unfamiliar to you and so many information may be thrown at you in one shot. And it's really, really good advice to come with someone else, 4 years or better than two. If you don't understand something, ask for clarification. If you want to get a better understanding, ask your doctor where you can find it. Some patients are really, they really get passionate into, for them it's really important to understand even the biology of the tumor, the statistics, the details of the numbers. Other patients don't care, but some patients do. So ask me, can I see the study that shows the benefit of this chemotherapy? Or can you indicate to me a good website where I can find information about the chemotherapy? Don't do it on your own, because you can easily end up getting the wrong information. Get specifics about what to expect in terms of side effects, both short-term and long-term, and how the side effects are treated. And the patient says, and also talk to the nurses about that, I guess. Maybe they feel the nurses sometimes are more realistic than the doctors. And also ask if you can talk to other patients. Because the cancer that the cousin or your neighbor had 20 years ago is not the cancer you have today. You know, the fact that your grandmother was throwing up during chemotherapy doesn't mean that you will be throwing up during chemotherapy. So you might want to ask your doctor, can I talk to someone who got this treatment to get maybe the point of view of a patient, you know, and that we can help you with that. That would be much more reliable because, again, all cancers and all treatments are really, really different at this point. If you have young children, take the time to explain to them in simple terms what's going on. And this is a very good, you know, advice I find. Kids are scared by the unknown. If you take the time to explain to them, they're much less scared. Maybe ask one family member, as this is very true for the Italians and for the Greeks, you know, okay, if you have big families and everyone is calling to give advice, to ask how you're doing, it can become like a full-time job to answer the phone, and maybe it's a bit too much. So you can ask maybe someone else of your family to deal with the correspondence and, you know, and dealing with the other family members to keep them up to date on your situation. And again, don't let other people's advice confuse you. You know, I'm sure they all mean well, but they can easily drive you crazy. You know, you should eat vitamin D, eat meat, don't eat meat, drink meat, don't drink meat. Oh my God, you know, by the end of the day, you've done 2,000 mistakes. So you have one doctor, you have one team of doctors, you have one nurse. Ask these people. Again, all the suggestions, I'm sure they mean well, but sometimes they can be more confusing than helpful. If you want a second opinion, ask for it. There's nothing wrong. We won't be upset at you. We don't take it personally. Sometimes maybe it's good to hear two different voices or or, you know, who have two different, you know, personalities and point of view, or to convince you that this is the best way to go. So feel free to ask for that. And my advice is check the Hope and Pope. You know, they're out here, and, you know, it's an amazing organization. They do an amazing job in helping patients, supporting them, educating them, getting them in touch. It's done by patients for patients, so that's, it's invaluable resources. There is one place you don't have, you have to be very careful not to go. You know, Dr. Google is killing people every day. So, you know, it's kind of funny, but I personally feel it's becoming an issue. And again, I have nothing against you being an informed patient. I like when my patients are smart, they're on top of it, they understand what's going on. It makes things much easier. I don't want a stupid patient that doesn't understand anything. But going on Google, you can easily get the wrong information. People who are happy with their lives have no time to write on Google, so you find only the sad stories and, you know, the people who are, you know, so angry they spend their day Googling about it. And ultimately, going on Google leaves you alone, I find. You know, when you do have a team of people that you can ask and team up with. So I ask myself, and then I leave you alone, which are the two questions I would ask my doctor if I had a cancer? So the first question I would ask, and again, maybe it's not your question, but is if the cancer is curable or not. This, for me, is important. It creates a mindset. If the cancer is not curable, I need to come to terms with it. I'm happy to know maybe, you know, how much can I live with this cancer, but, you know, it creates a mindset, so it's important for me to know that. And it's not true that the cancer is always there to stay. This is like all the Italians in Montreal think so. Like, you know, oh, you got a cancer diagnosis, the cancer will be there for life. No, not necessarily. Some people are truly cured of their cancer, so you don't have to, you know, to live like you're going to die tomorrow if you don't, you know, if that's not the case. And the second question I would ask my doctor for sure is there any clinical trial that's available for me? And this is not just because I'm very passionate about research and about, you know, clinical trials. It's because we do have evidence that patients in clinical trials actually benefit from being on the trial. So it's not only for the sake of science, and, you know, and against the interest of the single patient that we push for clinical research. This, you know, and there are several series, you know, patients treated on trial or off trial. This is actually striking, you know, even. It's a bit more technical. But this, for example, this is study done in Quebec, which is, you know, on a big number of breast cancer patients. These are all patients, all had surgery in Quebec for localized breast cancer. And these are the chances of doing well, you know, going down in time, unfortunately. The patients that will do the worst are the patients that will be treated off study and without following the guidelines, you know, because some people think, okay, you know, the main advantage of being on a study, which is true, is that even if you end up in a control arm, for example, you should be treated in a very rigorous way according to what the guidelines recommend. So that's, you know, at least very, very good. So you see that the patients in blue that are treated with the standard treatments according to the guidelines will do better than the patients that are treated by doctors that maybe don't follow the guidelines very, very well. But the patients that will do the best, the patients with the best outcomes, even better than the ones treated with the standard best guidelines, are the patients going on a clinical trial. I mean, this might be biased, you know, if there's no trial for you because there's a very straightforward cure, let's say, testicular cancer can be cured with very standard chemotherapy, so there's no studies done in these patients because we know how to cure them. But when the situation is more complicated, you know, it might be really more convenient for you to look for a trial. Why do patients on trial do better? There may be several reasons. As we said, you know, even at the very least, they are followed in a very rigorous way by a whole team. There are some very practical aspects. You know, this, for example, is a drug that's been proven to prolong the life expectancy of the patients with advanced breast cancer. And for some technical reasons, shall we say, he wasn't available in our hospital for quite some time, even after we knew that the results had shown this very positive result. And the Jewish were blessed enough to have a study that for more than a year was able to offer this drug to our patients together with a new molecule, which was also very interesting. So it was like, you know, a win-win situation when our patients were getting the new molecule, which was very interesting, and also the best standard of care, which was not yet available, you know, through the hospital yet. Or this is an example of a patient of mine who in August 2014 went on to a trial. He had a very advanced bladder cancer, We were not expecting anything good for him at this point because he had gone through several lines of chemo and the cancer had become very aggressive at that point. In August 2014, he went on to this study, and to this day, not only he's alive, but he's doing remarkably, amazingly well. Amazingly well. And this is one of the drugs that is coming, you know, soon to revolutionize the way we are doing oncology. Atezolizumab is a very strange name. This drug was actually approved by the FDA in May of this year only. And we hope to get approval for Health Canada, which is a bit more strict, maybe by next year. So as you see, you know, my patient, you know, by going into this trial, he had a very early access to the drug that is reshaping the way we treat bladder cancer more than 2 years before it will become available as a standard of care. What is magic about this drug? And this is what we are going to, you probably, you know, everyone has heard about this in the news, you know, it's coming up everywhere. This is what we are working on. This is what is getting us very excited, the concept of this new wave of antibodies for immunotherapy. These are antibodies that don't attack the cancer directly. These are antibodies that go to basically, this is a tumor cell, which through these receptors, it blocks the immune system, because normally the immune system is supposed to recognize the cancer cells as the bad guys and kill them off. So something goes wrong when the cancer develops. And part of the way the cancer inhibits, you know, the immune system is through these PD-L1 molecules, and these new antibodies are going to remove this inhibition so that the immune system can be reawakened and re-attack the cancer cells and kill them off. This is a very fascinating concept. It does not work in most patients, unfortunately. So some patients are extremely blessed, like the patient I told you about. Immunotherapy works in a small number of patients on its own, but what is remarkable is that in these patients it will work for a very, 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 very long time. So we are trying to understand more and more who are these patients that respond very well, or how do we potentiate the effect of the immunotherapy in a way that everyone can benefit from it. So my conclusion is that no life is perfect. It's not because you have a cancer diagnosis that your life is less perfect than mine. You know, we all have problems. I'm not trying to minimize the impact of a cancer diagnosis, but I see far too many people just letting the cancer stealing their life away from them. You are not going to have another life where the cancer is not there. And this is true whether you are cured or not. If you have an incurable cancer, you have to live with this. You cannot wait for the cancer to go away to go back to your life. Even if you are cured by cancer, this is something that will change you forever. And you decide if this changes for the better or for the worse. And it's not just, you know, a nice quote sentence. You know, I see every day people choosing for this alternative and choosing to take this as a provocation to recenter themselves on what is essential in their lives for themselves and for their family. Thank you.
So our second speaker tonight is one very important member of the treatment team, the nurse Pivot. And we're very lucky to have with us Louise Champagne. Louise has been treating patients for a long time, 20 years at least. She's particularly affected to colorectal cancer patients. Population. She works at the Siegel Cancer Center of the Jewish General Hospital. She graduated from Laval University with a Bachelor of Science in Nursing, and then she went on to do a Canadian Oncology Certification in 2009. She's been working in oncology for 20 years, so she has seen a tremendous number of patients. So Louise, we want to hear about your experience, and we want to hear about the great work you're doing. Good evening, everyone. I'm very happy to be here. So I hope everybody hear me well. So when you read this sentence, what comes to your mind? Does it sound like, now what will happen to me? Will I die? What will happen to my children? I'm a single mother. I have to continue to work. So now what will happen to us? Does it sound like, now what will happen to my elderly wife? Will I be able to take care of her, or will she be able to take care of me? The now what can also mean, now what do I need to face this? Where do I start? Who should I call first? Will I be as lucky as my neighbor who had metastatic cancer 8 years ago? Because that can happen. The point that I want to make is that each individual being told that they have cancer do experience it very differently. Why? Because each one has their own life experience, their own beliefs, their own needs and concerns, their own strengths and resources to face life challenges in general. So I want to illustrate today to you how the PIVO nurse can create the condition in which the person can discover and use their own strengths and resources to while they are going through that overwhelming period in their life. So when we are being diagnosed with cancer, I mean, it threatens the patient's powers of self-determination. It evokes feelings of vulnerability and powerlessness, fear, denial, disbelief, despair, distress, and anxiety, insomnia, and irritability. It provokes patients to reassess their values and their life goal, the immediate and the long-term goal. It disrupts the physiological, psychological, social, spiritual equilibrium. And it requires patients to process a lot of information at once and to adjust quickly. So the studies have shown that when patients are less anxious, they are able to discuss and consider options treatment. When they are better informed, they participate more actively in decision-making. So it's important to assess distress early. And yes, it's important to assess it early, but not only at the diagnostic phase, but at any point in the trajectory of care, in the cancer trajectory. And talking with the PIVO nurse about the questions or the thoughts that comes to your mind may help decrease your anxiety. And it could be a simple question such as, well, I need convalescence after my surgery, and who's going to arrange that for me? Don't stay with the questions. You can call the nurse. From what I see in my practice, being available to respond to the patients and the family's concerns and questions early helps to decrease their anxiety and empower them. Also, helping patients find ways to cope with their anxiety may prevent it to escalate to a level of distress. So this is the National Comprehensive Cancer Network. The National Comprehensive Cancer Network have identified other periods of vulnerability. So like what we discussed before, finding a suspicious symptom, then you have to go through the test. And then you're informed you have a diagnostic of cancer. But then you have to go through other tests again, CT scan, MRI, PET scan, to determine, as the doctor explained, if it's spread to other organs in your body. So this is a very stressful period of time. Also starting the treatment. I mean, you want to know how it will impact on your quality of life. What are the side effects that are possible? How it will affect your schedule. And you may worry if the treatment will affect also your fertility, even your sexuality. Also, another stressful time is when there is a change in the treatment. Because, for example, maybe you were hoping to have, if I look at my own population, if you were hoping to have a temporary stomach and you found out that finally it's going to be a permanent one, that can be very stressful. Also, if you are informed that you will have your surgery, but then you find out that no, that would be better to start with chemotherapy and you'll have the surgery later, that also is stressful. The end of treatment, you know, maybe you can, you may feel that you're on your own again. Because after some patients, when they are under the treatment, they say, okay, the cancer is being attacked. And when the treatment is finished, sometimes they worry, well, will the cancer still be attacked? And so that could be a period of stress. When you're discharged from the hospital, you want to know who you can call for instructions about the wound, about any symptom. Maybe you want to know if you should go to the emergency or not. The stressors of the survivorship period, survivorship meaning being in a remission or being considered cured, still you may feel that you're on your own again because now this is a phase where you have to adapt to your new normal. And maybe you have some sequels from the treatment, from the chemotherapy or the surgery, and that could be impacting on your quality of life. Also, maybe you want to return to work, and sometimes it's progressive, and that could be also financial worry. Then we have the medical follow-up and the surveillance, when you have to come back to do the CT scan and, you know, all those tests every certain at a certain frequency. That can raise also some fears that the cancer may return, like what we call a recurrence. And when you have a recurrence, which is the return of the disease, then you may feel that you had to, you feel you had to start all over again, and like the diagnostic of cancer. But on the other hand, I mean, you have acquired some knowledge about the first diagnostic and some skills. Being diagnosed with advanced cancer also, and also end of life, the end of life fear to be abandoned, existential suffering. So the point is that the PIVO nurse can meet you at any of those vulnerable periods, and will remain available depending on your needs and concern. So this is here. This is a schema to illustrate really the cancer care trajectory or the cancer journey. And the yellow illustrates really the ongoing availability of the PIVO nurse. As PIVO nurse, we have an extended knowledge about the cancer trajectory and about the patient and family cancer experience. And therefore, we can anticipate your needs. We are part of an interdisciplinary team of a particular tumor site, like you have a PIVO nurse for breast cancer, you can have one in gynecology, hematology. And usually we follow a group of patients and family. You can be referred to the PIVO nurse right from the time of your diagnostic or later, depending on your needs. And yes, you can ask to meet a PIVO nurse. If we look on the left side about prevention does not refer only to cancer prevention. I mean, we do teach patients and their family about the cancer screening test. But also cancer prevention can also mean promotion of healthy behavior. And that can start right from your diagnostic. There could be a good nutrition, exercises. I mean, exercises, as there is studies that demonstrated that doing exercise can actually help you to tolerate the treatment better. And also it can prevent a recurrence of the disease. There could be also like limitation of alcohol, trying to stop smoking. Also mind and body modalities such as relaxation, Tai Chi, Qigong, that can be also very beneficial because it can improve the physical and psychological well-being by reducing the stress and the anxiety. Other behavior that promotes health and healing is during your hospitalization, early mobilization to prevent complication and to prevent muscle loss. Good hand washing to prevent infection. And as I said before, survivorship refers to remission or being cured, but also that can start right from the diagnostic, and this could be an opportunity to acquire and maintain those healthy behavior. Prevention can also mean prevention of distress by alleviating the suffering. For example, you could be going through the radiation or the chemotherapy, and maybe you have a lot of pain from your tumor. You may benefit from the support care team, palliative team, for their expertise in pain management and pain control. So in this context, palliative does not mean end of life. It's all about symptom management. And at the end of life, yes, I would like to explain that also, that maybe you and your family have decided when it's the end of life that you want to spend some time together, and sometimes some patients, they want to die at home. We didn't discuss that before, but this is something that can happen. And yes, the nurse people, we can connect you with the CLSC nurse, with the NOVA nurses, with the team, and this is something that if you want to talk, you can always talk with the people nurse. And we understand that the focus would be more on dignity, comfort, and cleaning of the mind. So, this is an overview of the cancer trajectory. Now I will go rapidly to explain what the PIVO nurse do exactly. So we establish a trusting, collaborative partnership with you and your family and the treating teams. Our focus is really on health and healing, and there is four key functions of the role of the IPO, which is the IPO, infirmière PIVO in oncology, or PIVO nurse. So we do assessment, we provide support, teaching and information, and coordination. And I will explain them at the next slide. But I just want to take a few minutes, to talk about Florence Nightingale's vision, who was the founder of the modern nursing. She founded the first school of nursing in the world. And as Florence Nightingale, she described healing as a process of restoration or recovery from a disease. And she recognized that the human body and mind have innate restorative and reparative capacities, and that the nurses could empower the patients to contribute to their own healing. So being healed does not necessarily mean being cured. Healing refers to our capacity to recover, to feel better, to cope, and to regain balance. So in the assessment, what we do, the PIVO nurse, we can help you with symptom management. It could be appetite, sleep, pain. Pain, for example, how are you taking the medication prescribed? Is there other strategy that you use? Are you applying cold, warm? Are you using the mind-body modalities such as relaxation? What helps you, for example, to feel less anxious? Is it to be informed in advance? Is it to talk with someone, to walk, to exercise? Is it to meditate? You may want to talk with the nurse PIVO about what is the meaning of the diagnostic for you and for your family. Or it could be later in the trajectory when there is a recurrence or a progression of the disease, and maybe you want to talk about end-of-life matters. And patients and family are often comfortable to discuss these matters with the nurse. If you're a young family, maybe you worry about who's going to take care of your children when you're going through the treatments. Or it could be how to inform them. Or maybe you worry about how they are coping with your illness. So we could refer you to a social worker who is specialized with a young family. We have also the program en famille. If you're over 75 years old and having comorbidity, such as diabetes and hypertension and obesity, and you live alone, and you have to go through surgery, and maybe you worry if you would need a convalescence, if you would be able to return home, or if you need convalescence or rehabilitation, this can be discussed with your PIVO nurse before you go to the surgery. it might be also appropriate to refer you to the senior oncology clinic. What if you are the caregiver of an elderly and you worry about who's going to take care of him or her if while you will be hospitalized? So we can organize temporary hébergement or respite care. You may have also other concerns about financial or transport. So we really encourage you to share with the PIVO nurse your needs and concerns. And as needed, we can refer you for additional support. So getting to know you, because each patient and each family is unique. We want to get to know you. People want to be listened without being judged or given already made solutions. Most people want to decide for themselves. So these are the type of questions that I would ask you. What is your immediate concern or need? Trying to identify your priority. What information do you need and how much? Because some patients want to have, having too much information can be quite overwhelming. So it's important to respect your readiness. That's why you must tell us what you want to know and what you don't want to know and when you feel ready to be informed. And what, in your opinion, would be best would be the best help for you right now? What has helped in the past? Here we are trying to look at your own capacities and because you have your own capacities and knowledge. And I must say that you have the power to choose what you think is best for you. Very important. Who is your main source of support? And in your opinion, what do you think they need? Here we are looking to make, to prevent caregiver burden. Sorry. So, strengths and deficits coexist, so health and illness. It's a question of balance. So what can we do together to help you regain your psychological, physiological, spiritual, and social equilibrium, your balance or your sense of wholeness? So this is the other key function of the PIVO nurse, is to provide support, being present. Being present means not necessarily being there, but also being with you, being connected with you and your family. And as I said before, we can follow you for many months or years. It depends. We do provide active listening, anxiety reduction, anticipatory guidance, assistance with problem-solving process, and decision-making. We reflect and mobilize the use of your own strengths, capacity, and competencies, and we mobilize external resources as needed. And we do facilitate clinical interaction. For example, we can be present during your medical visit. We help you and your family understand the medical plan because we would, you know, usually we would provide you with more information. And we help also the interdisciplinary team understand you, who you are as a person, as a family who is going through cancer. So we answer your questions and we help you understand your illness and its treatment, and we teach you about how to prepare yourself to the, and your family before the treatment and what are the possible side effects. We can inform you about what to expect after the surgery, what to expect in terms of possible sequels on the body image or on the body function. And having the information will help you make an informed decision. So we provide you with evidence-based knowledge, and we inform you about credible sites. So the PIVO nurse helps you navigate the system by connecting you to the different professionals and the different teams in the hospital and also in the community resources. Could be other PIVO in other hospitals, could be the CLSC or convalescent. We help you also coordinate your appointment and your tests to make your life easier. We can visit you during your hospitalization and also in the emergency department. So we play an advocacy role for the patients and the family. This is the last slide. Navigating the resources. So, as I said, you want to navigate credible sites, and usually each hospital or cancer center has their own resources or program that you can consult on their web page. I will go briefly with all of them. The Cancer Nutrition Rehab, this is a clinic where there is a nurse, a doctor, a physiotherapist, a nutritionist, and if, for example, you lost a lot of weight and you feel deconditioned with a lot of fatigue, we can refer you to this team. The senior oncology, these are for over, if you're over 65 years old with comorbidity, maybe you can be referred there. Also, to the young adult clinic, if you're a young adult, or if you're an adult but having very young children, we can refer you to this team. As I mentioned before, the support care team or palliative does not mean end of life. Sometimes we involve them to help you with the symptom and the pain. The psycho-oncology program, where they have psychologists and social workers who are specialized with cancer. We have the Hope and Co volunteers. We do a wonderful job. I mean, there is the one-to-one peer support who are cancer experienced volunteers who can speak to you when you're newly diagnosed. And they have also support groups. And I forgot to mention, when I was explaining about the teaching at the center, we also have group sessions for teaching about the chemotherapy and radiation therapy. So these are the resources. So there's a lot of resources out there. There's a community resources, there's your family and your friends, but most of all, there's yourself. Yourself with your own strengths, your own inner resources. And you may discover strengths that you never thought you had. Thank you very much.
So our third speaker tonight is a very special person. Dr. Caroline Rousseau is a senior clinical manager for the Rossi Cancer Network. So this is a relatively recently created network that's responsible for coordinating the activities. And Caroline takes care of 7 disease site teams and the advancement of the network's scorecard. She'll explain what that is, I suppose, across 3 academic hospitals. She has a PhD in experimental medicine from here, from McGill. Apparently, I was one of her teachers over 10 years ago. And she has a lot of experience in clinical trial management in oncology and hematology. So, Caroline, it's great to have you with us.
Okay. Hi, Hi, thank you for inviting me to speak tonight. I'm going to talk to you about what we're doing at the Rossi Cancer Network to improve the cancer patient experience. Sorry, I'm a little bit nervous speaking in front of a patient audience. I know that you guys pay much more attention to doctors and PhDs, and I'm not really used to speaking to such an attentive crowd. Okay. So what is a patient experience? Here we have a patient that's about to be administered a patient satisfaction survey. You see, the patient is very comfortable at this moment in their treatment. But the patient experience is more than just smiles and comfort. It's knowing that you're getting the best treatment, knowing that you're getting the best treatment for your care, for your cancer. Knowing that you're getting treated in a timely manner, that you're not having huge long wait times to get treated. And it's having access to all the information and services that were discussed today that you need for your care. So I thought I would go through a little bit of an example of a patient experience here, because a patient experience is not just one time point. It's a sum of a whole bunch of different experiences. Here is the emotional state of the patient, and here is the patient journey. So the patient is at home. You have a hospital appointment, so you're getting a little bit nervous and anxious. You drive to the hospital. You have trouble finding parking. The parking costs $25. You're unhappy. You're stressed. But you can't find the department because it's your first time to finding the oncology department. Then you wait for your doctor. You're happy. You're waiting 30 minutes. It's fine. You wait an hour. You're getting a little more nervous and anxious. And you wait 2 hours to see your doctor. So you're more and more frustrated. Then you see your doctor. You meet Cristiano, and he's wonderful. So you're very happy, and your anxiety goes down. And then you leave the doctor's office, and you wonder, did I have enough time to ask all my questions? Am I missing some information? And your anxiety goes up again. So the patient experience is not just one time point here. It's all of these time points. And when we talk about the patient experience at the Rossi Cancer Network, it's a little bit more narrow than that. It's the patient experience at three different hospitals, so the MUHC, the Jewish, and St. Mary's. So it's that moment in time when you need to see specialists, when you've gone through your family physician, when you've gone through the imaging or testing, and now it's time to see a specialist for diagnosis and treatment. So what is the Rossi Cancer Network? The Rossi Cancer Network was launched in 2012 thanks to a very, very generous gift from the Rossi Family Foundation. It's a $30 million gift over 10 years. The Rossi family, as you know, owns the Dollaramas. And this gift was with one condition, and is that the McGill and the three teaching hospitals, the Jewish, St. Mary's, and the MUHC, and McGill, all pool together some of their funds as well to make the gift bigger and more powerful. And also to engage the hospitals in working together. So each the gift over 10 years is totals $50 million. So what are we doing with this money? What's the goal of the Rossi Cancer Network? The patients that go through the three different hospitals, the patients get treated at one hospital. Sometimes they might have a treatment in another hospital, and they're not unique to one hospital. So the gift is to improve the quality of care at all the three academic McGill teaching hospitals, so MUHC, St. Mary's, and the Jewish. And the long-term vision is that every door going into a McGill teaching hospital should lead to similar world-class cancer care experience. So what does that mean, world-class? It means outstanding patient experience. It means innovative cancer treatments that involve clinical trials, giving you access to the best and the most up-to-date treatment early on. It means that the hospital can span the patient care trajectory from diagnosis to end of life to survivorship. It means that we train and educate healthcare professionals, and we do community outreach and education. So this is what we're aiming to do, is to become this world-class cancer center that includes all the three teaching hospitals in McGill. So as you experience the hospital, you realize that it's a giant beehive of activity. There's so many different teams working together. Your specimen has to go someplace. Then you meet your surgeon. Then you have to work with the pathology department. It's so many different professionals that need to interact together. And this needs some coordination. So improving the patient experience is also about improving systems. It's about decreasing delays. It's about giving you access to the proper treatment. It's about improving multidisciplinary care that Cristiano and Louise talked about today. Sorry, Louise. And it's about promoting safety and security. So what do we mean by that? Well, washing your hands is one thing, making sure your physician washes their hands every time they touch you. But it's more than that. It's making sure that your surgeons are up to date on the latest technique so that your surgical complications are as low as possible, your risks are as low as possible. So how do we improve these systems within the ROSI Cancer Network? We have two main ways to improve the system. So we try to harmonize the care behind the scenes. So this is more of a top-down approach. And we also give the workers of the healthcare system the opportunity to innovate and to make improvements from a bottoms-up approach. So let's talk about the top-down approach first. We have seven disease site groups that manage the quality of care across the three hospitals. The disease site groups are led by co-leads, one lead from the MUHC and one lead from the Jewish. They have a steering committee that includes also clinicians from St. Mary's. This is a multidisciplinary team. So we have seven disease sites. We have breast, gastrointestinal, genitourinary, gynecology, hematology, head and neck, and lung. Some of these teams have started working on quality improvements already, such as reducing delays for diagnosis and treatment. Some of the teams are working on developing treatment guidelines to make sure that patients are treated the same way at whatever hospital they enter. These groups are also working on an online repository of active trials so that doctors can know which trials are open across the three hospitals, because clinical trials are hospital-specific. So you might have a trial that's available at the MUHC, and you have a trial that's available at the Jewish or at St. Mary's. That wasn't yet, but no, not yet. Not yet. Soon. Yeah. What? Too fast. Okay. So the trials that Christiana was talking about before are also available for your viewing. You can go to the ROSI Cancer Network website and see what active trials are open for your disease at the MUHC, the Jewish, or St. Mary's. There's also a supportive care group that just got started at the ROSI. This group is tasked with transitioning the patient from active treatment to survivorship, providing psychosocial support, and dealing with end-of-life care. One of the projects that was funded and by the ROSI Cancer Network is a communication tool to help patients talk about important issues such as depression, pain, fatigue, and anxiety that Louise talked about before. So I'll just show you a little video that explains this project in a little bit more detail.
We need your help. Each time you visit the Cancer Center, you may be asked to complete questionnaires that gather information about your symptoms and other concerns. You may be asked to complete them electronically at a computer station, on a mobile device, or with a paper and pencil. The questions, which may vary from one visit to the next, are important because they help your team understand how you're doing and build a care plan that's tailored just for you. After you complete the questionnaire, you and your healthcare team will discuss your symptoms and concerns. Your answers help your healthcare team make the most of each visit, find problems early, ensure you receive the right care at the right time, and learn how to better care for you. The information you provide will also help you talk to your team about a treatment plan that is best to reduce and manage your symptoms. Your voice is important. Your experiences are important. Be an active part of your cancer care by completing your questionnaires as completely and honestly as you can. We look forward to working together with you.
Thank you. So this is a project that's available in the gynecology department at the Jewish, in certain lung clinics at the MUHC, and at St. Mary's for all patients being treated at St. Mary's. And basically, a patient fills out a questionnaire, and there's a printout with the status of the fatigue or anxiety, and that's used as a discussion with the clinicians.
Okay, well, I think we'll wait to see what happens.
it starts. And so my
name, I don't know where this is. Okay. That was interesting. Okay, and here's an example of some projects that we funded from a more of a bottoms-up approach. This is a project that arose out of the MUHC Reproductive Center to sensitize patients and caregivers and doctors about the possibility of fertility preservation. So this is not a topic that many oncologists are familiar with or discuss with their patients at that time. But it's important to know that it is a service that's available. It's covered by RAMQ. There's no wait time to see the patients. They're seen the next day after they're referred. And so the delay to start treatment should be very minimal. So this is a project that was brought about by from the funding from the Rossi Cancer Network. Some other projects include providing early compression therapy, seeing if early compression therapy helps with lymphedema in gynecological cancers, and co-designing a cancer survivorship program. And what does that mean? This is a project that was initiated at St. Mary's. And basically, as Louise mentioned, sometimes after treatment, active treatment, the patients are kind of lost. What do I do now? Nobody's taking care of me. I don't have my team around me. So this is a survivorship transition program where patients meet face-to-face at an orientation session, but also have access to different booklets talking about back to work, how to regain function and health, where to get reliable information, and dealing with side effects and symptoms. So how do we measure the patient experience at the Rossi Cancer Network? Maybe some of you have gotten these surveys or mailed to you during your treatment. Has anybody ever gotten those? No? We mail surveys, 150 surveys at the Jewish, 150 at St. Mary's, and 150 at the MHC and 115 at St. Mary's. And we mail those surveys every 3 months to patients that received active treatment. And basically, there's 100 questions, fill them out, and they're returned anonymously to a statistician who compiles all the questions and replies. And we analyze the patient experience to see where we can improve. So who replies? More women than men, not surprising. We've received about 2,500 surveys to date. About 40% of patients who are mailed a survey actually reply back. 50% of the patients are age 65 and over, and about a quarter with breast cancer. So one of the questions that's asked within that survey is, overall, how would you rate your quality of care over the past 6 months? So this is very kind of surprising, but, you know, 97 to 99% of patients rate their care as excellent, very good, or good. So we're doing pretty well, right? How are we doing compared to the Canadian average? Because this is a survey that's sent Canadian-wide, and we can compare ourselves to the Canadian average. So we compare very well to the Canadian average. Maybe Canadians are just more satisfied with their care. Another question, do you feel your care provider did everything they could to treat your cancer? And overwhelmingly, the majority is yes. They believe the care provider did everything they could to treat their cancer. Would you recommend your care provider at your hospital to your family and friends? And once again, most patients would recommend entirely and completely their care provider. So we think we're doing okay, but we have 100 questions like this. And every question can be used to begin a dialogue on improvement. And we can be better than the Canadian average. We don't have to just meet the Canadian average. We can be better. So what kind of questions have we worked on so far? What kind of questions did we look at and have brought about improvement projects? So here's one on radiotherapy. The question was, do you feel you received enough information about radiation therapy side effects? And patients felt that they did not receive enough information. So we created a radiotherapy booklet specific to the MUHC and the Jewish, where radiation therapy is given, and a video also explaining the radiotherapy journey. So that's gotten 3,000 views. The booklets are available online, and you can also access them on the website. Another question. Did a care provider tell you how to manage any side effects of IV chemotherapy? So as we know, one of the side effects of chemotherapy is that it can weaken your immune system. And if you develop fever, it can be dangerous, and you need to potentially get treated with antibiotics. If you show up to the emergency with a fever, you're going to be with all the other patients that are there sick, and you don't want to be standing in that emergency room. So there's little treatment cards that we developed that are given to the patients that are undergoing chemotherapy treatment. And they allow you to have express triage and treatment when you arrive at the emergency room. So that can reduce the incidence of potentially dangerous infections and allow the emergency room to administer the antibiotics within 1 hour, which is the guidelines. Another issue that we noticed during the questionnaires was, do you feel that your family doctor knew enough about your cancer care? This is a project that was initiated by Dr. Sadalka at St. Mary's to create treatment summaries that allow a communication with your oncologist and the family physician. So the treatment summaries are given before you start treatment, and there's also a treatment summary at the end of treatment. And this allows to provide regular updates to family physicians and to be alert to any possible complications. 96% of the family physicians responded that the treatment summary provided very pertinent information relevant to their practice. We know that cancer survivors are living longer. We have much better treatments now than we had 20 years ago. And family physicians are expected to provide continuity of care. But evidence shows that while family physicians are already caring for survivors in their practice, an overwhelming number of them feel ill-equipped to do so due to lack of formal training or adequate support. So Dr. Chaput developed a training program for family physicians. She provided workshops that are accredited to teach family physicians about possible delayed effects of chemotherapy or radiation therapy, and to inform them of surveillance needs. At the first workshop, she was expecting 30 to 40 physicians, and 125 physicians showed up. So you see that there's really a need there for informing the family physicians on how to take care of long-term survivors. So I just want to thank you for sharing all of your patient experience through many surveys, insights. We have patients working on some of our committees. So we have we get the patient insight on some of the projects that we're developing, which is also hugely valuable. I want to thank you for participating in clinical trials at Advanced Care and for being an active part of your care. So if you want to find out more, we have patient resources, the clinical trial listing, and newsletters, so you can find out more about the Rossi Cancer Network. Thank you.
So thank you, Louise. Caroline. Jeez. And our last speaker for this evening is Madame Sophie Demange-Brousseau. Sophie is currently a patient. She is going to talk to us about her journey of becoming a good patient and a better human being every day.
Microphone feels weird. I'm one of Dr. Ferrario's patients. I'm a lucky one, a really lucky one. The ones who know him a little bit know what I'm talking about, but you have seen what he's capable of and how much he cares about people. So I've had the chance of knowing him since 2013 now, so it's been 3 years. I've had that chance of meeting him because I was going to die, actually. 3 years ago, my health was not so good. But I'll start from the beginning. I had my diagnosis in 2011, I was 27 at the time, so it was kind of a life-changing news, just like everybody else. But for me, it was shocking because I had no one in my family. I had no clue I could ever get cancer one day, even though we all know that it's for everyone, right? So I got my diagnosis through the surgeon who had made the follow-up with me with the lumps I had discovered myself. It took some time because at first, because of my age, because of my health condition, he couldn't think of a cancer being the cause of those lumps. So it took about 8 months before I got the surgery, and with the biopsy we actually find out that it was cancer. So at that point I just reacted like the commercial shows. I don't know if you've seen it, but when you just fall down and you can't believe that it's happening to you, that that you've heard those words, the word cancer, it's still so frightening, and it's as if we still have this image of a person who's gray and emodium dependent and nauseous all the time, and although it is true that you go through side effects, many of them, I don't believe that that it's all you got from cancer. That's not my experience, because I've had the chance to have some good treatments that not only helped me get better, but that didn't affect me too much on my health level. So in 2011 and 12, I got some chemotherapy and radiotherapy. And after that, I thought I was all good, but I got some more bad news the following years when my breast cancer was actually had actually gone to my bones. So I was not able to walk for about a year. And that's when I met Cristiano. He met me when I was in the soins palliatifs. I have a hard time saying that in English. So I was admitted in the emergency room in December 2013, and was told that I was probably going to die in the same evening. So that was a little bit shocking to me at that point, because I was about to turn 30 on January 1st. So I wanted to live till my 30s at least. So I tried to make the best decisions I could make at the moment, which was to be transferred to the soins palliatifs, where at first you get the impression that, well, it's because you're dying, you are going to die the next day or whatever, because soins palliatifs still resounds as if it is just when you die that you go there. But I was lucky enough to learn that, well, at least at the Jewish hospital, you're just given the time to take your time to breathe a little bit and kind of digest all those information. And so we took good care of my health. A lot of organs were affected at that point. I had liquid in my lungs. I had a lot of liquid around my heart too, and I couldn't breathe by myself. I needed oxygen. I couldn't walk. So the doctors were not very optimist at that point, but my great gift was on December 24th when, again, I met Cristiano, and he told me I had three options. So we went from me dying during the evening to having three options, which sounded even better than what I thought I could expect. And I didn't know how it was still possible for him to have that kind of cheerful and optimistic view on my file, because every other doctor that had seen me was not giving me such good news. But he still gave me three options, and like he said earlier, actually he said everything I wanted to say earlier. He covered it all, because it is true that he really listened to me. He made sure that what I was going to get was what I wanted to get, because at that point I was not sure I wanted to continue on chemotherapy, because I was so scared with the side effects that mentally I felt so tired that I was not in a position to think really well of what the options were. When he explained that the side effects were going to be his task, that the side effects were there just for him to know if the treatment was working, to know if I was responding well, but that I didn't have to suffer and to go through having so much pain without saying anything or to just try. Because I had thought that maybe I had to have those side effects, that it was, you know, what cancer was. But he really made sure to explain everything I wanted to know and to listen to what I was willing to go through. But it was not, like, obvious at the very beginning that I was willing to actually continue. But he took his time and didn't make me feel as if life was over. So, and an important thing he said earlier, but I'm going to repeat it because it was really important for me to hear from him, is that it's funny how people, healthy people think that, you know, life is forever, you know, that we're eternal, which is not the case at all. But he really put the emphasis on saying that, you know, you don't know when you're going to die, but I don't know either. Like, it's not for anyone to know in advance, actually. And I realized that also when I was watching the news from my bed, and young people were getting in car accidents and were dying at, like, 19 years old. So I realized that it is true how much you don't know what's ahead of you, and how you have to just focus on the present. And I know that it's easier said than done, but that's really what's helped me go through everything. Because I don't know for you, but for me, hearing all of the previous speakers just made me go back and all the emotions I had through all the years, and getting it diagnosed and all the information, and it's so overwhelming that you really, really have to take it, like, one day at a time and 1 hour at a time, actually. But I think it's the only way to actually go through it. And when you think of it, it's not only with cancer, but it's with life. And that's one thing I learned, too, is that maybe it's a gift, actually. And I know that it sounds all made, or I don't know how to say. I don't even know the word I would say in French. But it really doesn't sound as if it was true. But it's been 5 years for me, so I really understand how this cancer has given me the chance of focusing on what's really important in life, on seeing what's really important in life. When I think of it, it's not as if you get a lot of different chances in life to actually stop and think of what really matters to you and your family, because you're just in the crazy, crazy routine of going from the subway to work back to back to home when you're where you have kids or other things you have to take care of. And so when you have this opportunity of just stopping and taking care of yourself, I think it can be a great gift. So I know it's really easier said than done, but that's what I think is the most important thing, is really your attitude. This is one of the only choices you have left, because we know that you have some choices, of course, in depending on the treatment you want to get or anything, but it's the ultimate choice you have is really your attitude and how you want to go through it, because it's the same way as you're going to go through cancer or as you're going to live with cancer, is the same way as you live your whole life, because it's not one or they're not apart, it's just the same thing, really. And so I really think it's the attitude and having the tools also. And both Cristiano and Luis talked about, and Carolyn too, talked about all the help we're going to get from the nurses, the doctors, everyone, really. So I've never felt like I was alone in this, but ultimately you're still alone living this disease and feeling every effects, good or bad, that it can have. So I feel that if you can at least choose how you want to look at it, well, at the end of the day, it kind of gives you this power still, this control on your life, because otherwise you really feel sometimes a little bit helpless, I think. André, the comedian, André Sauvé, was on TV yesterday, and he said, what did he say? I wrote it down here. Ne pas attendre d'avoir la chance de frôler la mort pour apprendre à vivre. I think it would be great for everyone to be able to focus on the things that really matter in life, but sometimes you have to have something like cancer. So I guess my way of seeing it is that cancer can be a gift sometimes. So I was told that maybe some questions were going to come from the audience. I don't know. I didn't want to take too much time, and so we could have more time to answer.
Okay, so I would ask the four speakers to come up to the table. While you're writing your questions on cue cards, I'm going to take a few minutes to tell you that there is a survey online where you can fill in a number of questions, like some of which are just like Caroline has suggested, but also how useful this has been to you and what you would like to hear in the future. We use this to prepare next year's series, so please be generous and tell us what you want to hear. The other thing is, you're our best advocates. So if any of you are on Twitter and want to tweet and tell everyone how great this forum is, this is the hashtag that you can use for this. The other thing that you ought to know is we have a lot of help from a good number of people, first of which is Annette Novak, standing right there. Annette is key to helping us put these forums together and to communicate with the clinicians and the patients to get them together in this room. We also have a lot of help from students who volunteer for the evening and the McGill Women Cancer Research Center staff that are helping to put this on. Tonight was a bit special. We had a number of organizations that are working in cancer that were present at kiosks during the introduction. Hope and Cope, we thank you very much. Canadian Cancer Society, the Rossi Cancer Network, and the Cedars Cancer Foundation. I'm sure that you probably had a chance to go through and pick up some of the information. They are available online. They are in hospitals and treatment centers. So if you need any help, please don't hesitate. Now, questions. Okay, a question for Dr. Ferrario. Micrometastasis not visible on scans. Could you detect by blood tests?
That's a very good question. I think that's what is going to be in the future. There are tests that can look for cancer DNA in the blood, or also what we call circulating tumor cells. And we do know that if we find these cells in the bloodstream, from the blood test, there's a higher chance that the micrometastasis might be there. But the correlation for the time being is still not 100%. So we don't have any clinical study, so to say, that has proven that these tests are more reliable than the way we otherwise, guesstimate the risk of the micrometastasis being there just based on the staging and the tumor type. So this question is super, super pertinent. There are, again, the technology is getting there, and I think that's probably how it's going to be maybe just in a few years. For the time being, the use of blood tests, even if you send your blood to Germany or to the States to do this type of analysis, it is not proven that we gain information that is more reliable than how we will manage otherwise.
So another question for Caroline this time. Can the Rossi Network help a cancer patient obtain a treatment that is not current in Quebec, but is given in another province?
So the Rossi Cancer Network itself cannot do that, but there are people within the cancer network that you can talk to, the clinician being the first one. They do know about how to get access to drugs that are not approved here, either through clinical trials or through special access, which is when the pharmaceutical company allows patients to have access to drugs before they're on treatment. So I would suggest you talk to your clinician first.
Sophie, there's a question for you, but maybe you'll need help from Cristiano. Why were you told you would die in the next 24 hours in 2013, but you're still here to talk about it now?
Yeah, I realize I didn't say much about that. Because I had some liquid on my lungs, because I had some liquids around my heart, my cancer was really metastatic. And my level of calcium was through the roof, and so I had many symptoms progressive cancer. But I chose to have chemotherapy after all. He convinced me to have it, and so I've been on certain clinical trials since then. I've had chemotherapy. I'm still on chemotherapy, and that's how I survived. And of course, by choosing a healthy lifestyle, also sleeping a lot, eating well, exercising, and all of this.
Doctors can be wrong sometimes, believe it or not. I think you were in a life-threatening situation. If I may, you had sort of postponed the decision about the chemo for some time, and I think you were getting to the point where the decision had to be made, right? Yeah, so I guess maybe the doctors were trying to, shall we say,